Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 3, Episode 4, Every Man for Himself. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and where would I hide the $10 million I stole from the government? It's buried under a tree in the mountains. You know, that one tree.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and there's a big hayfield up near Buxton, one in particular. You know, it's got a long rock wall, a big oak tree at the north end. It's like something out of a Robert Frost poem. It's where I asked my wife to marry me. We went there for a picnic and made love under that oak, and I asked, and she said yes. Promise me, Red, if you ever get out, find that spot. In the base of that wall, you'll find a rock that has no earthly business in a Maine hayfield, a piece of black volcanic glass. There's something buried under it I want you to have.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I stole $10 million from the United States government, I am putting it in the Hydra station, which we learned this week is on a tiny mystery island next to a larger mystery island that I guarantee you the IRS is not finding. So,
yeah. Everyone's trying to keep some money safe from the con men because this is a Sawyer-centric episode as we're here for Season 3, Episode 4, Every Man for Himself. If this is your first time joining us, you should know we are a rewatch podcast because all six seasons of Lost has already aired, but we are watching a new episode every week. We have been going from season 1, episode 1, and are up through season 3, episode 4. If this is your first time through and you do not want any spoilers about what's going to happen on either of the islands, as we learned this week, you could stay in the calm section. That's the first section here where we will not discuss anything beyond season 3, episode 4. If this is another time you're going through Lost, maybe your second time, maybe your fifth time, maybe your 42nd time, that magical 42nd time, and you want to discuss this episode in the context of all six seasons of Lost, you could stick around for the second half of our podcast. It is called The Storm, and that's where we talk about Lost, assuming that everybody had seen Lost and, you know, read some of the ancillary material and are interested in crazy theories and remembrances. And last weekend, for instance, we got together to watch the finale with some of our fans. You too, because it was the 10-year anniversary, not just because we just watched the Lost finale randomly in the middle of season 3.
That would have been a good thing to do randomly.
Yeah, it's true. Although it was a nice little shot in the butt to power us through these early season 3 episodes. If you want to get in on things like that, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you can support us at various tiered monetary levels at a monthly subscription model. At the very lowest level, you get access to our Slack, which is where we do our watch-alongs, and you get access to a podcast Joanna Robinson is doing with a friend of the pod from over the Buffering the Vampire Slayer podcast. It's called Feels Like the First Time. Joanna, what's up next with Feels Like the First Time?
Oh my god, actually, we don't know, because Kristen and I took the week off because Kristen's packing up her apartment in New York City. Coronavirus Central. So she needed all of her time and energy to be doing that. So,
I know a thing. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, there's something there that everyone can get for free, Joanna. Isn't that true?
What's that, Neil Miller?
Is it a thing that maybe we also did this past weekend?
Is it a thing that maybe we lost some sleep over? Yeah, Neil and I got some, there's no feels like the first time right now. If you want to tweet at Kristen Nolene, or me at Joe Wrote This, or in our Feels Like the First Time Slack channel on our Patreon Slack, you can suggest something for us to do next. We are currently taking suggestions. People have been dropping some fun ideas in there, so we have not decided. We are listening to you all. But if you are thirsty for another podcast to listen to, in the absence of Feels Like the First Time, Neil Miller and I put together a Lost finale anniversary celebration bonus episode that is free for everyone. You don't have to be part of our Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/dramaspoilers, it's living there. We rounded up a bunch of guests, including Jorge Garcia. You might have heard of him. Jeff Jensen. You might have heard of him. A bunch of podcast hosts and TV critics you might have heard of as well. And they're all just sort of like reflecting on the finale and what they think. It's very spoilery, but it's just sort of a nice look back on the occasion of the 10-year anniversary. So that is something you can enjoy, whether or not you're a Patreon. But if you are a Patreon subscriber, I should say, I suppose, you can, I don't know, do stuff like watch a movie with us this weekend. We're watching Bad Boys together, a movie I've never seen. At 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 30th. So that's like something you could do with us. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Neil's watching Breaking Bad with everyone. We might switch to another show to watch with everyone soon. So like, there's a lot going on over there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's patreon.com/stormspoilers. You can go to stormpodcast.com to look at our schedule. You can find us on Twitter at Storm Podcast, and that's a good place to vote on our Jungle of History polls or like other things that we do. Or you can always leave us a review or email us, host@stormpodcast.com. I'm going to hit some reviews and then hit a few emails. We had a bunch of reviews, so thank you guys so much, because like some week we get none and we got like a few this week. So thank you so much. This one comes from Rick1980. And he says, one of my faves, been listening to this since the GOT days, but my interest increased when they moved into Lost. It's my favorite TV show of all time, but I've held off rewatching up until now. Having this as a companion to the series literally made me want to see it all again. I'm loving it as much as the first time around. The three hosts are a great mix. I listen to any review show that involves Joanna, and I'd recommend you do the same. Keep up the good work. Stay safe. So thank you, Rick. And then this one is from Craig. In New Hampshire. Best podcast around, 5 stars. I've been listening since the beginning, and this is my first review. Sorry. I love hanging out with this crew every week. I've recently been releasing to all the episodes from the beginning because I needed some distractions during this quarantine. Let me tell you, it's worth it. When they announced they were transitioning to a Lost podcast, I danced around my apartment for 20 minutes. I called all my Lost friends to tell them the great news, because Lost is my favorite show. Keep up the great work. So thank you so much. We got a bunch of others, but like, that'll do for now. I like that people are starting to really leave a lot of Lost reviews. That's fun, because like, I think it took us a while to shake our Thrones reputation. So thank you all. I will hopefully read some more of those in the future, and we appreciate you. And then I'm just going to hit a few quick emails before we dive into this delightful Sawyer episode. The first one isn't really an email. It's actually a couple tweets that our guest from last week, Jody Avergan, sent me. And, you know, last week we met two attractive people on the beach, named Nikki and Paolo, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Jody sent me something from Lostpedia that I was unaware of. Maybe you guys were already aware of this, but, a deleted scene from that episode actually introduces Nikki and Paolo by Claire finding them having sex inside Jack's tent. And Jody sent that to me saying, whoa, how did we not know this? And then he sent me a follow-up that said, like, that's how you introduce characters. Can you imagine the first two people to actually do it on this island? I mean, let's honor Ana Lucia and Sawyer, but like, the first people to actually do it on this island are two random people you're meeting for the first time.
Caught doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two random people you're meeting for the first time in Jack's tent. So Jody seems to think that would be a better way to introduce them. I kind of agree. What do you guys think?
I definitely agree.
Yeah.
Like, that would be a much better way to do it. And, you know, they're really hot too, so. That wouldn't hurt.
I wonder if they cut it because it indicated that Jack's tent was somehow like better, and that there was like some sort of tarp shortage, which there clearly isn't, and would ring.
Oh, false. Yeah. Now we need to know the whole story of why this was cut. Like,
yeah, is it like a vengeance thing?
This is not
like,
enough.
We're gonna have sex on his bed.
Time or what was going on here?
Why did they cut my? I was a general in that army. God damn it!
I'll put on my list of things to ask Damon Lindelof.
Excellent. The ever growing list.
Yeah. This next email comes from Abby, and she says, "Hey, loving the show. One thing, can't believe you didn't comment on Tale of Two Cities originally beginning with 'This Must Be the Place,' parentheses, Night Melody, by Talking Heads. Juliet literally is seen playing the Speaking in Tongues CD. Obviously, in the final cut, this is replaced by the song Downtown. I don't know why they replaced it, whether or not, like, they were more consciously trying to match the Desmond intro or they couldn't get the rights to the Talking Heads song. I wouldn't usually include this email because... with love and respect to Abby, I usually don't respond well to people saying, "I can't believe you didn't mention blah," because it's a little annoying because we mentioned a lot of things. But, you know, I don't mind being corrected. That's just a phrase that gets my hackles up. That being said, I love the Talking Heads so much, and I actually didn't know this fact. So, I appreciate Abby raising it. It's a perfect song. It's a song that like really chills me out. So if I were Juliet and I were hosting a book club with that whiny guy coming, who's not Ben, but still annoying, and my
muffins definitely is going to want to talk about Ben.
Right. And my muffins were burning. I would definitely put on This Must Be by the Place by the Talking Heads. Neil, do you have like a chill out song, a song that would like make you chill out before, you're hosting Carrie book club?
I don't, it would probably be something from the work of the Parliament Funkadelic. Like, it would be like a funk song. Cause I want to feel like, it's not really a chill out thing. There are plenty of things you can do to chill, I think, but it's like I need a good energy. I just need a good energy in my world, you know?
You want to get your mood up.
Yeah, exactly.
Dave?
Oh, there's a song by Dan Deacon. I think it's called, no, the album's called Bromst, but it's like a 7-minute song that has a build to like a cacophonous, conclusion that is itself like 2 minutes long. And I like that. I like building songs. Build and then break with me music. And then I can be relaxed.
Okay.
This last email comes from Nicola, who, actually goes by Nikki. She makes a point of that. I just wanted to point that out from the top. And
oh, look, our season 3 also has a Nikki.
Yeah. Great. And this is a really exciting, email with a lot of emojis. So I'm going to try to capture the spirit of this email that Nikki sent. It's called Thirst Trap Island. So it starts with Desmond. Desmond : do you have any insight to Desmond picking up Walt's psychic/electromagnetic ability? Hear me out. By my understanding, Walt's original storyline was that he was psychic. Were they leaving threads so they could pick it up later? I realize this is before Lindelof was on board. Flash forward to season 3, Walt has just left, then not too long after, Desmond moves in. Do you have any writer's room information on the possibility that Walt's storyline ideas were given to Des? And then she writes, Des is hot AF, and him being a woman man makes him hotter, Neil. But Penny, come on, girl. He full on negs the fuck out of her. Beep. But she's not letting go of her Burley Scott. He makes my ovaries hurt too, lassie. I get it. All right. And then Nikki says, which brings me to Paolo. And then it's that emoji that's like the horn o'plenty with like streamers coming out of it. You know what I mean? Like the like, yay. We have to go back to an 18-year-old me who very, and I mean very much enjoyed Paolo. Oh, clap. My clap, Lord. I grew up in shitty northern British city, not too away from Charlie's Manchester, and I had not seen anyone like him. Brazilian. Also obsessed with Hector. He better bloody come back. Maeve and I need him, and it wouldn't be Christmas without Carl. Big Rodrigo Santoro fan. I listened to Joanna's Westworld VF coverage. I would like to hear her notes on Devs versus Westworld. There are these weird asides that also have little, like, this email's a whole journey, and I appreciate you for writing it with, like, everything that comes with it. Okay. Back to the main thread of the email. My life took a flash sideways when I fell completely in love with my Brazilian husband, Bruno, at 22, while living on the South Coast. Razzle dazzle. We were about to celebrate our 10-year kissiversary. I'm Nikki. He's my Paolo, partners in crime. Luckily, we're both scared. Seeing Nikki and Paolo actually brings tears to my eyes. But if Paolo were anything like my husband, he would have played samba, fucked off the golf and made a football pitch, hugged and kissed everyone on the beach for hello, bye, shouted private conversation because speaking at regular volume doesn't happen, used Portuguese swear words, been so friendly and kind, listened to Nikki always, Nikki's are always right. I can't wait to hear all about they are so much beep. That's it. Have a fabulous rewatch. Also a fan of Down the Hatch and appreciate their survivor explications. Not in the UK. Don't fall down, Nikki. So that was Nikki's whole, I just really, it was like a ray of sun. It was like a Parliament Funkadelic song in email form.
Okay.
So to circle back to the beginning of Nikki's email, if you remember, we don't have any writer's room insight into this as far as I know, but do you guys have any thoughts about like Desmond maybe picking up some of the Walt story?
I like that idea, but I'm not sure if I can talk about why I really like it without getting bleeped. I do think that Desmond is the gateway for them that Walt could have been. Like, in terms of a character that's going to go in, like, that slightly more sci-fi direction, Desmond does take up that slack, even though Walt's gone just because the actor got too tall.
Neil, do you have any further insight?
Do I think that Walt would have and could have built some sort of antenna to use as a lightning rod? Yes, absolutely.
But how many... Never mind, he's a child. I don't want to talk about the buttons on his shirt. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to say is that our guest this week is Lonnie Diane Rich, who's like a hero of mine in the world of like breaking down story. You might have heard her on our finale special podcast if you listen to that. If not, please tune in for our chat this week. She has some great stuff to say about like storytelling and character work and why Lost gets a lot of that right. She hosts the How Story Works podcast, but you can hear her on our podcast after we chat in the calm. Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
Oh my. Joanna, this week it is Every Man for Himself in this episode, which was directed by our friend and yours, Stephen Williams. It was written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz, former guests on the pod. It has a runtime of 44 minutes, and it aired on October 25th, 2006. It takes place on days 70 and 71 on the Island of Mystery. In flashbacks, we visit James Ford during his time in prison, where he's busy uncovering a con by a crooked warden. As it turns out, he definitely doesn't have a daughter and definitely is not in on the warden's con. But somehow, and I know this is going to sound strange, he ends up getting out of jail, setting up a trust fund for a baby named Clementine Phillips, and getting the government to pay for it all by the end of the episode. And that's how Sawyer conned his way out of prison. On the island, Desmond is still a little weird following his survival of the hatch implosion incident, borrowing a golf club from Paolo, who is still hanging around and still terrible at golf. Des builds a lightning rod that saves Claire, Charlie, and baby Aaron from getting zapped, at least as far as I could tell. Charlie begins to suspect that we're in the midst of another island mystery, and it involves Desmond. Elsewhere, we'll get to that in a second, Sawyer begins working on a plan to escape the bear cage, only to discover that Ben is not to be underestimated. In an elaborate con that involves Ben murdering a bunny, he successfully cons the con man into calming down. Also elsewhere, Jack is convinced by Juliet to help try and save Colleen, who was previously seen being shot by Sun on a boat. Along the way, he spots the spinal x-rays of a man in his 40s with a large tumor on his L4 vertebrae. And there's, you know, a little bit more of that Juliet-Jack tension. It all ends with Sawyer learning that while there may only be one bunny and it's definitely still alive, there are for sure two islands. And he's probably in love with Kate. And Ben knows it. Fun fact, my friends, there is a second, smaller island attached to our Island of Mystery. This week's calm question, knowing what you know so far, how are you trying to get between the two islands? Like, let's say you're Sawyer or Kate, you can take your pick, and you get out of your cage. if you're Kate, you could just crawl out of your cage. How what, does it? It looks far too far to swim, I think.
Didn't we get it dropped in a throwaway line this episode what the answer to this question actually is?
Oh.
I believe.
What came back?
When Colleen comes back, they say that the submarine sandwich came back.
Sub.
Which everybody knows.
Sub.
Is the longest, most delicious sandwich.
Do they say that in front of, who do they say that in front of? Like of our team, our survivor team. Is that, is Tom and Ben talking in front of Sawyer as he's waking up?
I believe so.
Or they say it in front of Jack.
It's either that,
in front of somebody.
It's either that or like Jack hears the crackle over, cause he hears two crackles over his supposedly dead speaker this episode that I could remember. There's that
Sawyer.
One, or there's that, and then there's Sawyer yelling after like the torturing. But I think he does overhear a bit of dialogue, and at least if I remember from my watching along with the subtitles on, we do get a sub in those subtitles. But to play along with your question, Neil, I think that you gotta get like some sort of wreckage to build like a sailboat. And it occurred to me this week while watching a burlap sacked Jack move from one place to another that there's a little like portico tarp that you could probably rip down and make a sail from if Kate wants to like climb out of those bars, get a sail going. Now she just needs a raft base, which, you know, takes some time to build. But apparently not that much time, because Michael did it twice in the, you know, previous 60 days. So that would be my get. You got to build another raft.
All right. Joanna, are you going to try and swim like your namesake did?
No, I'll learn from the Joannas that came before me. I think if I'm Kate, I'm just on the lookout for that girl, Alex. I feel like
Okay. Because she's already met Alex. Alex would probably know about the sub and where it's kept.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Like if I'm Sawyer, I'm not necessarily looking out for Carl because he didn't seem to be like a great accomplice. But if I'm Kate,
we don't have a ton of faith in Carl at this point.
If I'm Kate, A, I can just climb my ass out of the top of the cage, and B, look for Alex. That's what I would do.
All right.
Do you think
that's a good plan?
Do you think the only thing that was stopping her up to this point was not having pants?
I think that's a big part of it.
She's like, man, those look wide enough, but I don't know if I need to try that yet.
Honestly, Dave, if I were wearing no pants, crawling up the side of a cage would also be a problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that dress was not escape friendly.
Yeah, but I try to think of it as like, what would I do, but if I just didn't have any pants on? And so, yeah, I'm not climbing out of that cage.
Yeah, that's true. Then you've also got, like, weird momentum problems. Anyway, we're here to discuss the Sawyer episode. As per usual, we're going to start with the flashback. As I've established in these previous Season 3 episodes, not a huge fan of the beginning of Season 3. That being said, I don't think this flashback is bad as much as it is unnecessary beyond establishing why Sawyer's in prison and sort of Clementine. But I think that's fine because it doesn't spend too much time out of that. It is sort of weird me out that they lampshade the entire thing by having one of the final lines being like, well, James Ford, you just conned yourself out of prison. Do 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 boop, like Looney Tunes circle wipe out of flashback. But that being said, I enjoyed what it had to say about the larger con, and I did appreciate it breaking up what is an otherwise very bleak hour of Lost. Everybody is beating up on Sawyer. Sawyer is cowed by a pacemaker, and Desmond's acting weird, and it isn't even obvious that it's sort of a pleasant weird until the very end. So we went dark real fast in Season 3 of Lost. Let's ask Joanna. Joanna, mm-hmm. Sawyer.
Yes.
Falls for this pacemaker con. Do you think that there are any cons within cons, like last week? Like, at some point, do you think Sawyer feels like he has control over this situation?
I feel confused about how to answer that question. What do you mean?
I guess, like, is there
a hat on that hat? What?
Yeah, a little bit. So last time we saw Sawyer, he had come up with, like, you know, this, way to kiss Kate that he also claimed was a con within a con to judge the security. And presumably that's why they're so aggressive with him this week, is so he doesn't go around, trying to try stuff. We know he has one con within a con that doesn't work out, where so he thinks he has the advantage with Ben, but then he learns they could turn the electricity off on the polar bear feeder. Is there any point otherwise in the episode where you think Sawyer has more of a handle on the situation than he's leading on?
No.
Okay.
I think they get him. Ben really does get him.
They fully get him. We have an email about this in the storm, but I think, you know, and some of our, like, some of our first-time listeners who were watching, I was sort of, like, looking at their live watch thread, and, you know, from the beginning, they were like, this feels fake. That's not how pacemakers work, blah, blah, blah. And I think if Sawyer hadn't had his, like Jack has backup against the wall, he would have been able to spot that con. But they are just, like, in extreme circumstances. And so, you know, and they're being tormented in a bunch of, you know, they're having psychological experiments played on them. And, you know, and I think that's the only reason why, maybe not the only reason why, because Ben is like an expert consman himself, but it is one of the only reasons why they were able to con the con man, I think, is because Sawyer's in this extreme position. And well, I agree with you that the prison plot line is not that interesting. I mean, like, I'm always happy to see Cassidy. We get the introduction of Clementine. But like this is a very forgettable flashback. But it, to me, it's an unforgettable on island. The Of Mice and Men, the bunny, and the like fake pacemaker con are all highly memorable lost moments for me. Ben and Sawyer, like, standing on the top of that hill looking at the other island talking about Of Mice and Men, this is like top tier lost moment for me. So that's where I am.
Yeah,
I feel like I feel the same way about the flashback, except one little difference in that I really do like everybody that's in it. Like, the cast is really good. You know, like, Bill Duke is in the flashback, and that guy was in Predator, so that's pretty awesome. But it's like a sort of mild flashback with probably a better cast than it deserved.
Yeah, they just, like, I think you really see in this opening, like, the Locke flashback is pretty weak, the Jack flashback is pretty weak, and the Sawyer flashback is pretty weak. What's the fourth one we've had in this opening?
Sun.
Oh, Sun. Yeah, it's pretty weak, too. I gotta say, all the flashbacks are pretty weak, but I'm, like, I don't hate, like, when people talk about these first six episodes being not great episodes of Lost, they refer to them sort of, like, as, like, the bear cage episodes kind of thing, right? The on-island stuff is not what bugs me. It's the flashback stuff. And it just really shows you, I think, that they have burnt through the, like, you know, they're not out of good flashbacks. There will be more to come. But, like, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that's not the premise of Lost all the way through. And I think you're really seeing the fatigue of that right here in these first few episodes.
Yeah, and we're sort of like scraping the bottom of the barrel as we're coming into the port of something. It's sort of like the best way. I mean, that's a couple of different mixed metaphors, but is it like the best
way?
Do
you scrape a barrel as you head into port? Is that something you do as a pirate?
Yeah, when you're a real pirate, you just call the ocean your barrel.
Oh, and then the bottom of your ship is scraping it as you go
as you pull into port
because the water's getting more shallow. Okay,
I have a question about the flashback. Does it?
The life's your barrel when you're a pirate. Okay. Sorry.
The ocean. Didn't I say the ocean?
Yeah, you did. But like,
the lake would be like a ladle that you
dip
in the
barrel. No, I said life is
your barrel. Oh, life is a barrel. Oh, yes. Life is your barrel.
Yeah. Okay.
What were you saying, Neil?
Well, so another question about sort of the flashback and the way I feel about it is that, and I don't know if I can say this is the first time that we're seeing this in Lost, but there is a quality to this flashback that feels fairly unfinished. So, like, the conversation that they have about the daughter. And I know that kind of gets wrapped up by the end of this episode, but that feels like something that could come back later. So it feels like there's some, and we don't necessarily see them do this a lot. Stuff that feels like set up in the flashback, but like, and then not to use it on the On Island stuff. Like, there's no part of the On Island stuff that's about Sawyer having a daughter or not having a daughter, you know?
Well, so I think that's kind of,
there's a certain quality about it that feels like it's, you know, it's not just interested in what's going on in this episode. It like wants to plant some things for
us. Yeah. I mean, the daughter thing is, you know, this is not the last we'll hear of Clementine, but yeah, the whole like prison, doing the con, getting con sort of thing, I guess is the like, yeah, super over parallel.
Yeah.
And then cast.
It wraps up really neat. And also it feels like there's some things left unfinished.
Right. Yeah.
So it's weird. Not all of them do that, I think.
It's like a tale of two wardens. One that's like, Ford, you did it. You did it, old buddy. Look at you go. Conning your way out of prison. And then Ben, who pretends to not read Mice and Men until it's the creepiest time to reveal you've read Mice and Men. Which
yeah, Ben definitely wins the creepy jailkeeper off in this one, which is tough to do because the other one was Bill Duke, as I said.
Right.
Do you guys ever just like sit up and think about how Ben is the best?
I mean, he's had a few power episodes.
I will
for
say
sure.
This, and this is something that we talk about a lot in our Breaking Bad live watch in our Patreon Slack. Ben is competent. Whether we like Ben is sort of, I don't know, undecided, but he's good. And what he does, like he really gets to Sawyer in this episode. And I think that's part of what they want to establish here is that like these really are not just random people. Like there's something else going on here.
Yeah. And then they also make the assumption that, Ben made earlier in his Henry Gale days, except Juliet makes it this time that they all make sort of communal decisions, which is absolutely not true by what we've seen. And the show seems really interested in presenting like the sort of contradiction of who the others are, where there's the thing that they say, you know, they make decisions as a community that they're there to, you know, sort out good and bad people. And then there's the reality that we see, which seems like Ben is, you know, controlling everything. And we have no idea exactly why they're taking people and who they decide to take. If anything, that's even getting more complicated. And then the third lie, or maybe lie, that they keep throwing at us at the beginning of the third season is this idea that the others aren't in their nature violent or killers. Colleen said, you know, to Sun that, you know, we aren't going to be violent unless you, like, shoot me. And then Ben reiterates that they're not killers this episode.
Doesn't Desmond say they're, like, going to see the hostels at one point, too?
Listen, like, okay. We've talked about this a little bit in the storm, and I'm happy to bring it now into the calm.
Mm-hmm.
I reject wholly this attempted rebranding on the part of the others to be like, we're the good, or like, what happened to them? We did, like, all that shit. No, because who's dead? Scott and or Steve is dead when Ethan came up out of the ocean like some sort of deranged Aquaman. So like, no, they're killing people. It's not Scott and or Steve is dead. So like, we're peaceful. No, they hung Charlie from his neck. They stole a pregnant lady. Like, no.
Yeah,
they don't get to do this.
That's true. And, you know, when we first see Ethan, you know, at camp at the beginning, of this season, right? That was only a couple episodes where we see Ethan again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't look like Ethan's like the black sheep of the group. You know, he's not
plumbing or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's like, not like the neighborhood serial killer that everybody ignores.
No,
what I'm saying. So
this
was part of the plan.
Brody in the village.
There's
sorry, I just never thought I'd make an Adrian Brody in the village.
You're just like, oh my god, you just remembered all of the village at once in one bright moment. I guess like they're making it a point. I think the show is, and I don't think it's necessarily as like a retcon as it's like you cannot trust anything these people say. We don't know why, but they're consistently lying.
But they also can't resist the urge to recontextualize everybody that we're meeting. you know, they did this with the survivors. And I think this might even go with the idea that they're sort of running on empty when it comes to the flashbacks, which is like now they have these new people to mess with and they have these new people who they're going to try and make us confused at least, or make us question whether they're good or bad. And I think it's been really effective up to this point. Like, I do think there's a point where, yes, we remember that Ethan killed all those people, but like, and specifically the introduction of Juliet helps here because you're like, not all of these people are all bad all the time.
No, there's nuance. Like, I will accept nuance, but I won't accept this whole, like, and maybe it would have helped if they hadn't made Pickett such like a raging asshole who I hate. So like, if they had made him someone who I didn't like knee jerk hate, then I would care more that Colleen is dead.
Yeah, and he's upset about that.
Yeah.
Well before.
I just hate him. I hate him. And so like he goes to pulp Sawyer's face, and wouldn't it have been a little bit more compelling if like I felt for him and thought of like, what if they had killed Rose and Bernard went berserk on someone? You know what I mean? Like, you know, what if? So if that's what they were going for, they pretty much failed with the, with Pickett, a character I hate.
I mean, I also think the show is totally fine with us not trusting them. That's, very appropriate reaction.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a cool power play. Well, in terms of if we're talking about arch storytelling, last season's mystery had a lot to do with like faith and like the Dharma Initiative, and this season it's just like straight up there are dishonest people and with like unknown intentions, and that's as scary as when they were like jungle creeps back in season one. So I'm a fan of what they're doing with the others. And I like how they're sort of layering on these different storytelling devices of showing us one thing and then having them repeat these Henry Gale obviously lies to us over and over again, just to keep us on our heels for the next big reveal coming, which this week is Island Number 2, like Neil talked about. Which we know that they're in a station called the Hydra, so we now introduce you, Calmies, to Hydra Island. And
where I've stashed all of my illicit winnings.
Yep.
Yep. In a bear cage.
If you ever get there, dig below beneath the bear cage.
You gotta figure out how the thing works. You push the button and the money comes out.
That's
you
right.
You need either one Sawyer or two polar bears.
Exactly.
To find this money.
All right. Also on the island, Jack is brought in to try to save Colleen. He can't. We get a little bit more information about Juliet, who's a doctor. She's a natal doctor. Does birth and baby things, and therefore is not used to the life-saving part of doctoring, that Surgeon Jack is, and doesn't even keep the defibrillator working. So Colleen dies, well, even though Jack says there's nothing she could have done.
We should say that this is not the main island. So the main island is, you know, as we've already established, the main island is where their like weird little suburbia is. We know that because we saw like the plane sort of crash on that. So they've got a home base on the main island, and they're not on the main island. So like someone was asking like, how do they get 20 copies of Carrie to the island, but they can't get a new defibrillator? And I just have to assume that back, on the mainland, they've got an actual defibrillator, and that like they're working with lesser equipment, at the Hydra station.
Mm.
That being said, I don't know if that were the case. I don't know why Colleen, when she shot, would go to the shitty medical station on Hydra Island and not, you know, where maybe some more functional, cause it doesn't really make sense for them. Like, I get that it sort of sells their whole, we're a peaceful people sort of mentality, but like, if you're a settlement anywhere and you have talking head CDs and book clubs and, muffins and stuff like that, you have a doctor who's not just an obstetrician and actual medical equipment that works, right?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's also probably going to be somebody who's emailing us right now that's like, when you're in an underwater environment that could have compressed oxygen, a normal defibrillator won't work because you don't want it to give off a spark in an oxygen-rich environment. So something, something, something. Because I saw that episode of House where Cusher sets a guy on fire in the iron lung.
Is the surgery also underwater?
Because Jack's underwater.
Jack's underwater, but then
oh, no, they move him above water. Yeah. Okay, cool. So stop writing your email, medical professional. You're right. I was wrong. Second theory, they had a scene where they just, he's like, do you have a defibrillator? And Juliet's like, yeah, but it's for bears. And Jack's like, well, that won't work.
Third option, they cut it because they're like, you know what? They had a new defibrillator, but Nikki and Paolo were having so much rambunctious sex on top of it that it broke and they deleted it.
It just broke it right out.
Yeah.
I like defibrillator for bears. I like that. Well, we have one, but it's for bears.
I just kind of like the idea that like Nikki and Paolo had sex on every single other thing.
Just had sex everywhere. Oh, yeah. We've been to the other islands.
Every tarp Nikki and Paolo have had sex on.
Yeah. They're like that giant foot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had sex where that other toe was supposed to be. All right. Elsewhere on our main island, actually just on our main island, not elsewhere, we have Desmond very worried about Claire's roof and getting a golf club from Paolo, who is not using the golf course like an asshole. Like, we're stranded on an island.
Well, who wants
to walk
through the jungle to get to the golf course?
Wait, is he chipping balls? He's chipping fruit, right? Or is he chipping balls?
Well, they're probably way out of golf balls by now.
Yeah, right? He's chipping fruit or maybe even rocks. Anyway, as long as they're not balls, I'm not mad that he's like, well, if it's food, that's its own question.
If they're rocks, that'll damage the clubs, but I mean,
okay, yeah, all your options are bad, Paul. Golfing options are bad, Paolo.
But luckily, he's there just in time to lend Desmond a club so Desmond can make his art lightning rod. That saves Claire.
Do you think Paolo's golf balls / rocks / pieces of fruit are just sort of like plunking down around poor Joanna's like drowned body?
That's actually secretly what Paolo is doing, is he's creating a memorial underwater with rocks for Joanna.
She'll be saved by the buoyancy of citrus.
Right, because no one else remembers Joanna, but Paolo does.
Paolo would. Reason.
Yeah.
He would.
I mean, it's very Paolo.
I mean, like, given everything we know about Paolo at this point, yes. It's Trey Paolo.
As a way into our corners section, Joanna, we're actually adding a new corner this week as part of this storyline. Would you like to give some lead up to our new podcast buddy corner?
Are we already in corners? That's fair. I mean, there's really not that much to talk about this episode. Yes. We're calling this new corner a Desmond Hume button watch because this is the introduction. Like, sure, we met Nikki and Paolo, fine. But this week we met a truly iconic character on Lost, which is Desmond Hume's very unbuttoned blue shirt. You will come to know it and love it. So we're starting a new corner, which we're called Desmond Hume button watch. We're assuming that there are 7 buttons on Desmond's shirt, though you can, like, email us if you think we're wrong about that. I just Googled what is the most common number of buttons on a man button-down shirt, and the answer the internet gave me was 7. So let's assume he's got 7, and we're going to look at this photo. Neil right now is looking at a photo of Desmond and Hurley looking at...
delicious fruit salad.
Oh, yeah. The Horno Plenty with the fruit salad that Hurley made.
Yeah.
And they are looking at Charlie's and Claire's tent and the lightning rod, presumably. Neil, how many buttons do you think are buttoned? Not unbuttoned. How many are buttoned on Desmond Hume's blue shirt?
Okay. So if it's 7 total.
Uh-huh.
Then I'm going to think that there's obviously the one at the top, but then there's kind of a close one. So then it's like 3 and 3. I think he's got at least 3 buttons buttoned.
That was my answer as well.
Yeah.
Dave, do you have any sort of...
Just the 3 at the bottom.
How do you feel about this, Dave?
I'm going to go with 4.
Okay.
Because you could see the top button.
You think it's a little higher?
You can see the top button, you can see the middle button. And so I'm just trying to judge if that's like a kind of a straight line because he's leaning forward, like distance between buttons. I'm going to guess he actually has more buttons buttoned than he does unbuttoned.
All right. So we're going to call it a 3-4 button. 3-4 out of 7 button episode for Desmond Hume. Scottish golf enthusiasm.
I really want this to turn into some sort of like early warning system. Like every time he has a certain number of buttons, then something's going to happen on the show. Like I want that level of detail somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't think Lost,
every time the number of buttons
has
is
it,
a number. Yeah,
it would be fun.
It would be great.
Or if the answer is always 4.
I think it's always hovering around, like maybe on a formal occasion he gets up to 5, but I think that's as high as Desmond goes.
Like a formal meeting at the, around the fire or something.
If you can't see 5 inches of collarbone, it's not working out.
You know, I just found a photo of him that like the Ringer used on a thing where he definitely has like one of the lower buttons is unbuttoned too. So he has only 2 buttons buttoned. So we have to like consider that a possibility.
That he's just buttoning the middle one and then whatever buttons he feels like.
Yeah, I will do a better job of finding us like a good shirt. Look at the shirt next time we play this game. But for right now, we are saying it is a 3-4 button episode, and that is Desmond.
I'm sure people are going to try and spot him in the live watch. We'll just keep notes.
That is Desmond Hume's button watch. The end.
Welcome to the corners. Before actually we get here, there was one more thing I wanted to mention. In the official Lost podcast, which we will also get to as one of our corners, they mentioned that there's a stealthy Stephen King reference in this episode, and that if anybody finds it, they get some sort of prize. Why are they so coy about it? Because it's not from a Stephen King story, it's from Stephen King's On Writing, which is his book that is half biography, half autobiography, half tips on just writing in general. It's from a section that describes like the power of words. I'm going to read it to you now. Look, here's a table covered with red cloth. On it is a cage the size of a small fish aquarium. In the cage is a white rabbit with a pink nose and pink-rimmed eyes. On its back, clearly marked in blue ink, is the numeral 8. The most interesting thing here isn't even the carrot-munching rabbit in the cage, but the number on its back. Not a 6, not a 4, not 19.5, it's an 8. This is what we're looking at, and we all see it. I didn't tell you, you didn't ask me, I never opened my mouth, and you never opened yours. We're not even in the same year together, let alone the same room. Except we are together, we are close, we are having a meeting of the minds. We're engaged in an act of telepathy, no Misty Mountain shit, real telepathy. And that nice. Inspired the rabbit.
I have a quick update.
Yes.
I've found a better look at Desmond's shirt.
Oh.
He has the bottom button open.
Oh, no.
So it is 3 buttons, but it would have been 4, you're right, Dave, if he had had that bottom button button.
If it wasn't the middle of the afternoon when it's casual time.
And then that scene is also, in grabbing that image, in that scene, I also was able to see that Paolo appears to be chipping, like, guava? Some sort of small green.
Oh, like seeds?
Unripe looking. No, it's fruit, but it's like.
Oh.
It looks like somewhat unripe. Maybe it's like inedible fruit that drops from the trees. I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't look like, it's not like a beautiful juicy mango. It's a little golf ball sized green fruit. And that is what he is using to honor Joanna in the sea. The end.
Hey, he's building her a green statue of the shark that ate her.
Neil, do we have any Giacchino corner this week?
We actually do. And it's interesting. There is a new motif that characterizes whatever is happening to Desmond. That's how I'm going to say this here in the calm. Is like obviously something is going on with Desmond, and it is causing him to be able to at least know what's going to happen in a little while, I guess. Like, you know. Or he can tell the weather. It's unclear. But whatever's happening to Desmond, there's a new musical theme for it. And it doesn't have a name just yet, I don't think.
Excellent. I'm sure it'll get a very punny name later on when we know what to call it. This week's Jungle of Mystery moment. Who is Jack there to fix? There's some x-rays on the wall. He knows he's there to fix somebody. Who is he there to fix? We don't know. We don't know anything about that person. Well, Jack knows a little bit about him because he's a doctor, and then it's like a middle-aged male, but that's all he knows. Mm-hmm.
It's a man in his 40s with a tumor.
We have some guesses.
It's John Locke.
We have a few guesses. But
it's John Locke.
It's not Juliet. That's what we'll say, right?
But, yeah, that's fair. Yes. She is not a man in her 40s.
Yeah. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Awards goes to Bunny Number 8, who takes such a convincing tumble in his little cage, he looks like he's dead. But he's not. He's okay. We're going to choose to believe that's...
Yeah, like, are we buying that?
I think it's
if we're
easier,
Sawyer, I guess. Are we buying that bunny's fine?
Just practically to me, it's easier to... dose a bunny and then shake it into unconsciousness than it is to put a little bunny-sized pacemaker on a bunny. I don't know how
or
much
to just have two bunnies.
I guess they have like enough free time to have a book club with muffins, so maybe there's a bunny Mangala somewhere over there.
Also, what was the bunny painted with? I want to know that it was humane.
Ooh.
You know? Like, what do you paint a bunny with? If I'm going to be letting Ben off the hook here,
hostsstormpodcast.com if you know what one uses to paint a bunny with.
Yeah.
Dear host, Storm Podcast hosts, bears aren't defibrillated. If they go into cardiac arrest, we let them die. That's probably what it is. all right. We have an accent quarter this week. Joanna.
I just want to say this. So the actor Ian Gomez, who a lot of people know as Andy from Cougar Town, but I know as first as Javier from Felicity. So he's of like Puerto Rican extraction, but I just want to say that like I loved him on Felicity. I loved him so much. Javier was one of my favorite characters. But now that I know that he is like an unaccented straight man, him playing this like flamboyantly gay, you know, man who like called the character Ben Benjamin and all this stuff like that makes me look like a little, it's like when I like knew more about Hank Azaria and then I tried to watch The Birdcage. So this isn't a real accent corner. I just want to say like Ian Gomez, I have some question marks around your Felicity performance. Though that's a J.J. Abrams show, so that's a J.J. connection there. I used to love that character. I still do. I just feel weird about it now.
It's just all bad dads and bad accents with this J.J. guy.
It's true.
The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award this week goes to Kate, who when Sawyer says, if you really love me, go. Kate says, I only said that so he'd stop hitting you. Which, yeah, right, Kate.
Which is why I'm going to stay with you, even though I don't have to.
I'm going to crawl back in my cage. As we found out in the horse episode, like, she says, I love you, too. Or, like, I'm afraid of, I don't know. It's something she and Sawyer, when he's, like, out of it, you know what I mean? I feel like
yeah, nobody's buying this from Kate,
right?
Is what we're saying.
I'm
we're
not saying buying she, you know. Are we saying she, like, only loves Sawyer? Not necessarily. She got caught in a net with Jack, you might recall. But, like, you know, you can, like, love one person.
Kate might have,
more than, you know.
She has love to give, like, there are trees and cages to climb. It is infinite in all scenarios.
She's in training. All right. Is it Jungle Kistery time?
It is. Yep. How did we do last week for the Jungle Kistery?
All right. So if you don't know, we have this segment called Jungle Kistery, which is like our listeners, as they're live watching in our Patreon Slack, can nominate, or after the fact, can nominate, people that they felt like should be kissing or they loved them together or whatever it is. It's basically like the shipping nomination. Or if you're a buffering listener, the Sexual Tension Award. So, I word search Kistery, which when I word search it is spelled K-I-S-S-T-E-R-Y. So just so you know what to put so that I can find it when you nominate them. So last week, our poll, you can go vote for it on Twitter. Our poll last week, in dead last place was Lock and Island Pudding. That's another term for the goop. I'm not sure that was clear when that was nominated. Second to last place is the Polar Bear and Mr. Echo.
Woo! The Polar Bear got to beat the Island Pudding. I'm happy.
32.9% of the vote went to Gooped Lock and Cyboon. I don't know what that, like, it was like Magical Mystery Boon or something like that. So I guess Diana abbreviated that to Cyboon. That's fair enough. She's working with a word count limitation. But the winner of the poll was Dirty Naked Desmond and Hurley with 41% of the vote. So there you go. This week, we've got four nominations from listeners. They all have one thing in common. I'll let you determine the theme for yourself. Number one from Katie, Ben and cameras. We mentioned on this podcast that our listeners have dubbed his lair the Ben Cave, right? So Ben and the cameras in his Ben Cave. Number two is from Kat, Ben and a dramatic prop. So, I mean, I guess that covers Bunny, but also covers that, like, telescoping
rod.
Yeah. Number three, from Tori, Ben and Bigger Alcatraz, which is what Tori is calling Hydra Island. and number four from Vera, Ben, Sawyer, and their book club. So it is a Ben week. Ben is going to win this poll. Like, Ben has rigged the poll, conned you all one way or another. He's going to win.
Oh, my God. The real con is that we like Ben. I don't know.
So you can go vote, Storm Podcast, at Storm Podcast. Is that our Twitter handle, right? Yes. Go vote on the Juggle of History poll this week.
Excellent. Our book club seems pretty obvious. Of Mice and Men. This is the time where I said I've never actually read Of Mice and Men.
Same.
Have you seen the film, either of you?
Yes. I think that's what, Mr. Muscala in the sixth grade, no, freshman year of high school did instead of making us read it.
I'm worried that if I try to recall anything from the movie, I will get it completely confused with the other classic story about that involves mice. Flowers for Algernon, I think, is the other one. That's the one. I know they're not related, in any, way that it's
I was going to be like, Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim is obviously what he's talking about.
Watership Down?
Sure. There's too many small rodent-related classics for me to be able to discuss.
So George and Lenny are the two main characters of Mice and Men, right? Sure. And then, like, Lenny is a, mentally simple, large, very strong man, and George is like his friend and protector, and they go around and they're like friends together. But in the end, Lenny like he likes soft things, and unfortunately he like kills a woman because he like thinks her hair is really soft, and then she's like trying to get away and he accidentally kills her. And so then George has to kill Lenny. He has to like put him down, right? So that like they won't like lynch him or whatever. And so then he tells Lenny to like think about the rabbit farm, like think of the rabbits and, like look out into the distance and think of the farm they'll have with all the soft rabbits and stuff like that. And he does it. And then George shoots him in the back of the head. And it's this whole thing about like, sorry, spoilers for Mice and Men, but like, it's this whole thing about like, you know, like Lenny is George's like only friend in this world, and then he has to like do this terrible thing. But like the stuff with the rabbits and look out of the distance and all that stuff, it all like builds into like their conversation on the top of the hill. But did you watch Bugs Bunny cartoons growing up?
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah. I've seen the Looney Tunes version with the dogs.
Oh, that's different. The like afternoon Ralph, afternoon like whatever. Like,
well, I thought there was one where sheepdogs. It was the big dog and the little dog.
There's Which Way Did He Go, George? Is like a whole thing, and it's like, and whatever that is, it might be a dog. I don't know. I think it's like an abominable snowman.
No, that's
remember.
A dog.
But he like picks up Bugs Bunny and like strokes him a little too hard because of the bunnies and of Mice and Men. It's an
I can swear those are, that's
thing.
The dog thing. Yeah.
It might be. I think you're thinking of the sheepdog, but I could be wrong. Please email us, hoststormpodcast.com. This has been Book Club Corner.
Yeah. I think Looney Tunes is about to be on HBO Max anyway. We can investigate.
Hell yeah. I was kind of hoping that, Joanna, you would describe the plot of a book that wasn't of Mice and Men, just to, like, further, you know, like, get Neil. But I will confirm that is the plot of the movie I watched, plot of the book I absorbed through Living. Okay. Where's Libby? Our corner where we figure out where Libby was in the flashback, since she's ever present and probably the smartest person in the story of Lost. In this case, she's telling Munson's wife, Lila, to get the money for herself, because that would be smart. Don't give it to Sawyer. Don't give it to the warden.
So just Libby's like wife. She's like a fixer. She's working with the warden.
Well, at this point, you know? In the timeline, she's like high on helping people with their lives. So she's given Desmond, the Elizabeth. And so now she's like on a world tour trying to help people out.
Okay.
Fun fact. There's both a dog version of A Mice of Men, seemingly, for Looney Tunes, and also a bit where the Abominable Snowman is.
That makes
Lenny.
Complete
so we were
sense, actually.
Both right, as it turns out.
As it goes with Looney Tunes. All right, it's time for the official podcast check-in. At this time in the show, there was also an official podcast running that ABC had David Lindelof and Carlton Hughes, the showrunners, talking about the show. There's a lot of interesting things in this week's podcast. So if you wanted to give it a listen, Lostopedia has a transcript, I believe, is also archived in MP3. If you are in our Patreon Slack, there's also a person there who has a running feed going. This week also includes a debate between Carlton Hughes and David Lindelof over if they killed Scott or Steve, and it turns out they don't know, and the actors who played them don't know which one actually died. But we're going to talk about next week's episode through the official podcast. I am going to read Carlton Cuse. Neil is going to read Damon Lindelof. Here we go. Start scene. So let's talk a little bit about the cost of living. Whose story is it?
It's Mr. Echo. Mr. Echo's story.
And of course, if you're listening to this podcast, you have also seen the promos that the network is doing, which make it clear that someone is going to die this week.
It's going to be one of those lame background characters, right?
Scott? Steve? Whichever one didn't die before?
Yeah, exactly.
Who is dead? Scott?
I think Steve is dead?
Okay, then maybe it's Scott.
One of those guys. Is it going to be somebody lame like that?
I think that would be kind of a cop.
You're not answering the question.
No, I'm not answering the question.
Is it going to be, when you say somebody's going to die, do you mean that it could be an other? Or is it going to be one of our main people that we know and love?
My guess is that people will be pretty satisfied that we are killing somebody significant.
Okay, fair enough.
Good.
Although, I am a little unsatisfied with that answer.
And scene. Wow. Who's going to die? I don't know, call me. You're going to have to tune in next week's Lost to find out.
Such a fun Dave move.
It is an interesting little insight into the way they promoted the show, because they did do that when it was running. They would do the, like, who's gonna die this week, or
this
what
week,
happened to Blake?
Someone dies.
The marketing folks at ABC were very into the mysteries, and I think that, you know, that probably didn't hurt people's perception of the show, where people really started to care about the mysteries. You know, I bet that probably had some small impact on that.
Yeah. Well, and like also by like season 6, they're doing specials called like All the Answers, which include like none of the answers.
Yeah. I mean, so, I think it's interesting the way they marketed Lost is really went a long way to informing how people reacted to.
We will be heading off to the island next week to figure out where that official podcast tease ends up. This week, Joanna, who are you talking to?
As I said, Lonnie Diane Rich, great stuff. Fellow Sawyer fan, loves her some problematic faves. If you're a Buffering podcast listener, you might be familiar with her work. We are thrilled to have on the podcast Lonnie Diane Rich, a TV commenting idol of mine personally. So I am thrilled to have you here. As I saw that you were tweeting about Lost, I was like, oh my gosh, yes, yes, gonna have you on. So,
Well, I'm so excited that you asked me because I've been wanting to podcast about Lost forever and I haven't been able to get the time together. My dance card tends to be pretty full. So the chance to talk about Lost with somebody is really, really exciting. So when you messaged me, and of course, I'm a huge fan of yours, I was like, oh my goodness, Joanna Robinson just messaged me. We're going to talk about Lost. I'm so excited.
And when I messaged you and I was like, well, what do you want to talk about? You're like, well, I just happen to be a fan of Sawyer and there just happens to be a Sawyer episode coming up. So let's do it. So let me start here. Yes. If you can, in a spoiler-free way, for some of our listeners who are watching Lost for the first time, going through their own journeys, mm-hmm. and especially in 2020, yes. maybe taking their time on thawing to Sawyer, given the rough place he starts in. So if you can, in a spoiler-free way, yes. talk about why Sawyer is a favorite of yours.
I have, okay, I'm not necessarily proud of this, right? But I have this thing with the dark and beardy guy, like the guy who's just damaged. I think part of that is because I really love a good character arc. And when you start from a low place, you know, it's a lot of fun to kind of see that go somewhere. And for Sawyer, you know, even without being spoilery, what we've seen up until now, we've seen some vulnerability from Sawyer. I think probably I started to turn around on him about the time he had the personal grudge match with the boar. I like when you've got somewhere to go, when you've got a character that you can grow with. So Sawyer for me kind of wraps all that up in this dark and beardy, you know, Southern guy exterior. And I gotta say, I fall for it every time.
Same. Yeah, that yes. movement, that character progression is something that I've been really thinking about lately with my, I like to call them my problematic faves.
Yes.
But you know, your Spikes, your Jamie Lannisters, your Sawyers, mm-hmm. all of those guys.
Yeah.
For mm-hmm. sure. And then, you know, you've made a career of really digging into the mechanisms of why some of my favorite stories like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or the MCU, mm-hmm. et cetera, what makes them compelling? What makes them sticky, in the public yes. consciousness? And I'm curious why you think Lost became as sort of sticky as it did.
Well, the first thing, I think Lost was full of mystery, right? You know, we have everybody, this plane crashes, right? And you think it's going to be this, you know, Lord of the Flies style thing. And as we move through, we find out that there's so much more going on. There's so much mystery. You know, we have John Locke who can suddenly walk on this island. But you know, I mean, my guess is that the way to, you know, cure paralysis is not to crash in a plane. Right. You know, then we've got all of these coincidences. We've got people whose lives intersected, you know, before we have Ana Lucia at the, you know, at the bar talking to Jack. And then, of course, you know, we see her elsewhere. We see Sawyer bumping into people. We see everybody kind of like interweaving, you know, throughout. And I find it kind of fascinating because it feels like it's a story that has meaning, that has deeper meaning. And the fact is that, you know, as Jonathan Gottschall says in The Storytelling Animal, humans are meaning-seeking machines, right? You know, and we get our meaning from our stories. We want to know what it all means, you know? And I think that we have these, you know, really exciting... Well, first of all, we've got a bunch of hot people on a beach. That is never a bad plan for a hit show, right? Just ask the producers of Survivor.
Sure.
So you've got all that basic stuff. You've got this sexual tension. We've got sort of a love triangle going on. So we've got all these kind of like soap opera elements going on. But deeper underneath, like, you know, characters are named John Locke, you know, Rousseau, characters are named for philosophers. So it feels like there's something deeper going on there. They're talking about themes that go beyond just, you know, I'm hot, you're hot, let's be jealous of the other hot person, like all of those things, right? That there's more going on. We're talking about, you know, fate, right? What does Charlie write on his hands? You know, he has late and then he has fate, right? You know, so these are themes. These are deep, resonant themes for all of us as we try to figure out what do we believe to be true about the world. We have all these people intersecting in all of these ways. That's not a coincidence, right? Something's going on. Somebody's running the show. There's meaning behind it, that it's not just all random circumstance. And I think that there's something about that that speaks deeply to people. And one of the things that happens a lot of the times, we have these big super hit shows, right? And we think, oh, it's stupid, it's lowest common denominator, blah blah blah. And yet things like Lost, things like The Good Place, things like Game of Thrones, I would throw in this category as well, have a lot of things that they are talking about, like deep, resonant, you know, human stories. We're talking about more than hot people getting it on in whatever, you know, exotic environment you want to have, right? On the back of a dragon or, you know, on the beach in Hawaii. Uh-huh. That there's more to it than that. And we are intrigued by these stories that sort of investigate these ideas for us. I think that the average person is a lot smarter and a lot more interested in philosophical questions than we necessarily give them credit for. And I would say that hot people be damned, right? There are plenty of shows with hot people on them. I would say almost all of them have hot people on them. But this show resonated so hard with people because we were asking ourselves a lot of questions. You know, it launched in 2004. That's 3 years after a world-shaking event, 2001, 9/11. We're asking ourselves a lot of questions about who we are, investigating ourselves, and how better to do that than through all of this philosophy. So I'm sorry, I went on for like 20 minutes on a very simple question.
I loved it. I laughed it up. So like a fish biscuit question mark. Okay. So, I think the other thing that Lost does, especially in the first season, you know, if you think of story, of whether it's film or television or fiction, as an empathy machine, as it's often described, that is something that I think Lost does really well, because what it forces you to do is it introduces these archetypes, and then it says, well, you know, especially in the case of someone like Sawyer, or, you know, more dramatically in someone like Jin, what if you've not understood what's actually going on with this archetype? What if you found out a bit more about their background, and how would that inform how you interpret their on-island behavior? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it is a surprise. Like, there are characters like Jin in the beginning. I hated Jin.
Right.
The way that he talked to Sun, the way that she was clearly terrified of him, and then to find all of that background and to see him change. And I think there's an essential question too, is like, can people change? Mm-hmm. Can you arc a character that, like, who they are at the beginning doesn't mean that's who they are at the end? And I think that the essential message of that is just hope.
Right. All right. So how does this episode specifically, this is a really good on-island episode for Sawyer. I don't love the flashback, but tell me how you feel like the marriage of the flashback on the island, on-island narrative, works for you in this story.
I actually like it. And the reason why I like it is because we have these two reflective stories, right? We have the two prison stories for Sawyer, right? He's in prison in both circumstances, right? He's in a cage. There's one where he's loyal to power, and the other where he's loyal to love, right? You know, in this prison story, he is loyal to Kate. It isn't until they threaten, as Ben says in the end, it isn't until they threaten Kate that he is, that he actually, you know, is plays their game, is steps in line, right? And then we've got one where he is doing the conning, and one in which he is being conned. Now, up until this point, Sawyer has been the one doing the conning in pretty much every circumstance, right? He's always the one running the game. Like, you know, he gets the guns on the beach in that huge, the long con episode, right?
Right.
So there's so many things. He's always running the show, and this is the one, like the on island story is the one where he is completely out of control.
This episode really sticks with me, not for a lot of the stuff that happens in the center of the episode, but for that final scene between Ben and Sawyer. And I think it's because it tells us so much more about Ben, not just the conning the con man gambit, but also the, you know, quoting back of Mice and Men to him, like all of just everything. All of it is just, you're just
I
like,
love that.
Yeah.
Don't you read?
Yeah. It's just like, it's so scary. And so I, you know, once again, without treading into spoiler territory, to me, something I've been saying recently is like, Lost doesn't become Lost until Ben Linus shows up. What do you feel like a character like Ben Linus brings to a story like Lost?
Oh gosh, a character like Ben Linus. Ben Linus comes in, he's a classic trickster, right? He's a trickster. He comes in, he's Henry Gale, he landed in a balloon, right? Nothing he says is ever true. But it's not a lie just for the sake of lying. It's a lie with a purpose. He is like a Russian nesting doll of lies, right? You know, you open one and then there's another one right inside of it. But the thing about Ben, you know, without getting too spoilery, here we're in this very early part of this understanding of him. We have seen him already endure beatings, endure Saeed's interrogations, right? You know, and he is just tough throughout the whole thing. Whenever he cried, whenever he whined, that was an act, right? And now here he is. When he goes to Sawyer's cage, right? Sawyer grabs him and tries to do the electrocution thing, which, by the way, badass move to run the electricity through you. Yeah. That's quite the idea there, Sawyer.
Uh-huh.
But he goes there and he beats the hell out of Sawyer. And this is the thing, like one of the things that I absolutely love, both about the character as written and about like Michael Emerson as an actor playing this character, is that we are seeing the guy who gets beat up doing the damage, right? I mean, Michael Emerson looks like the guy that gets beat up. Whenever you have like that guy in a show, he's not the tough, you know, gonna kick your ass kind of guy, right? So here we have somebody who's smart, somebody who's a trickster, but also can hold his own in a bar fight with Sawyer. I mean, granted, Sawyer's in a cage. Sawyer has been eating fish biscuits. That is not like necessarily, this is not Sawyer at his prime, right? But still, even so, he beat the hell out of Sawyer, you know, and then conned Sawyer. Like he got the best of Sawyer throughout this whole thing, playing him without even really breaking a sweat. I think that this episode, as much as it is a tick for Sawyer, it's also a tick for Ben, because we are beginning to understand just how dangerous and interesting and trickster. And I love me a trickster hero. Give me some Loki. You know, I mean, I love that. I will fall for that every time. And Ben is such a lovely variation on that trickster, because most tricksters do it because they're like, hey, baby, I'm into chaos. Let's just see what happens. Ben is a trickster with a plan.
Right.
Ben is a trickster with using all of these skills toward a specific end. And we don't know what that end is at this point. You know, I would say a lot of times, I still don't know if I know what his purpose was half the time. But he's so interesting. He's one of these characters that's just so interesting and crunchy, because he's so unexpected, and because we allow a guy who looks like that to beat the hell out of somebody who looks like Josh Holloway. I love that.
Everything that he does with the baton, I'm like, yes, yeah. I understand that. But there is one point when he, I think, like fully throws Josh Holloway's whole body across the cage. I'm like, no, Michael Emerson.
Yeah, right.
You can't heft Josh Holloway. All right, so I wanted to ask you about a couple more characters, because this isn't just Kate, Sawyer, Ben episode, because we get some healthy amount of Jack and healthy amount of whatever's happening with Desmond on the beach. So let us start with Jack. Jack, some of our listeners are having problems getting on board with Sawyer. Many more people are having large-scale issues with Jack, which is fascinating to me, because he wasn't an archetype that was as challenging when Lost originally aired. But now in 2020, I think there's something about Jack's particular issues that are really rubbing a lot of our listeners the wrong way.
Okay, Jack is not interesting to me. And he wasn't interesting back in 2004. And I remember a lot of people that I knew, anyway, who I was talking to, did not care for Jack.
Okay.
He is set up, like, we open in Jack's POV, right? What's the first eye? Considering the blinking eye is Lost, loves that. Oh, man, there isn't an eye blink that they will not close up in on to open up a scene or a show. But they open up on his eye. We see him, you know, he comes out, he's the hero, he's the one who's saving everybody. And as we move through, in the way that we see Sawyer kind of move toward being better, I think we see Jack kind of reveal the worst in himself. You know, the always having to be in control, always having to decide who goes on, you know, which things. Like, I think that they turned to him and they made him the leader to a certain degree, but he's also, like, really a control freak. And, you know, when you have him, you know, in comparison to Locke, who is there just to have the experience, who is there looking at the fate of it all and the mystery of it all. And Jack thinks he knows. He knows everything. And then when he turns out to be wrong, he's like, I don't care. I still know it. And he'll just go on to his next thing without questioning himself at all. I don't see Jack. And I don't mind that Jack's kind of annoying in a lot of ways. I mean, God, I'm annoying in a lot of ways. It's just that, again, I have that hope that I will change. And Jack doesn't seem to have that. Jack doesn't seem to think that there is anything wrong with the way that he is. He has that stubborn, you know, he'll fix everything, you know, kind of thing. There's nothing that I can't fix. At the same time, while I haven't been a huge fan of Jack so far, I kind of like him. I like him with Juliet. I love that moment where Juliet's like, are you trying to make me feel better? And he just laughs at her and says, I don't care how you feel. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good. I like it. I like when he grabs her and he's like, whose x-rays are those? Like, he's being smart when he's walking past the cages and they're shouting over this, you know, blare horn, and he just looks and you can, you know, his head turns and he knows they're there. There's something that I'm enjoying about Jack, and it may be because his back is so against the wall that cockiness and that confidence plays better here. I don't know. How do you feel about him? Do you like him any better in this stretch of the show? Because I like him better than usual in this stretch of the show.
Yes. Jack not putting other people in danger makes me like him better. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And Juliet is such a welcome addition to the show, and the way that she doesn't put up with Jack shit, especially in the season 3 premiere, really does a lot, to make me enjoy that dynamic. All right. So let us, then go to the beach. We get a little bit of Paolo, in this episode. This is obviously the Nikki and Paolo era of Lost. Yes. And then we get Desmond, doing his Desmond thing.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is Henry Ian Cusack's charm. I think that he exudes a tremendous amount of charm. Vulnerability in character is absolutely the most important element, because vulnerability is how we connect with each other. When we meet somebody who appears perfect, whose Instagram lunch is just their entire life, right? We don't feel connected with them, right? It isn't until they've got, you know, everything's a mess and they've screwed stuff up and their hair's all over the place. And, you know, it's like, those are the people who are truly, truly real, who are truly vulnerable, who are truly imperfect, that we can connect with. And I think that Desmond had that sense of vulnerability from the beginning. You can see it in the performance. You can see it in who he is, that he is always just a little unsure. You know, he's never sure if he's doing the right thing. He doesn't seem very sure about anything, really, you know. And when we see him, you know, in the beginning, when he just runs off, he's just gone. They go in the hatch and he's just like, later, dude, you know, and then returns drunk on the boat. You know, there's just all these really wonderfully charming and endearing parts of him that are so incredibly imperfect and really vulnerable in that way. Whereas with the other characters, I don't feel like we really got a strong sense of their vulnerabilities. It was there, but it just didn't feel like it was strongly expressed. And so I think people didn't respond to them as much. But Desmond has, of course, yes, Henry Ian Cusack, of course, the Scottish accent, of course, the open shirt. I mean, I'm not stupid. Yes, that's all part of it, right? But I think that there is more to him. And I think that, like, you know, through the run, he ends up becoming one of the more compelling stories that we tell in the show.
Yeah, you know, so something that I was, a unified theory that I was working on was that in order to be, you know, a really, really effective character on Lost, you have to have some sort of tragic, yearning love story.
Right.
You know, like, I have some later season examples too, but there are some exceptions. And so then I like this reframing of it as a vulnerability, a really yes. potent vulnerability. And that can be in the form of a love story, and a painful yes. separation, which is true for, like, let's say Desmond and Penny, or, right. you know, when.
Well, do you want me to go on my vulnerability run for you real quick?
Oh, please hit me with your vulnerability.
I have a whole run.
Yes.
This is my vulnerability run. All right. This is what I teach in my classes and in my podcast, How Story Works. The vulnerability, there are four major sources of vulnerability, and you can combine these in any way. Usually don't want too many different sources of vulnerability. One good one will last you a real long time. But it's fear, identity, love, and shame, right? So you have a huge amount of shame for Sawyer. That's the source of his vulnerability. Desmond, you've got love, right? That's the source of his vulnerability. That is the main thing that hurts him. I think Ben, it comes down a lot to identity. It's who he is, who he believes himself to be. Kate is shame. Right? Uh-huh. Locke is identity, right? You can go and look at the core of all these. Charlie's hugely is identity, right? Who is he? You know, is he a heroin addict? Is he somebody who can get redemption?
And that's also, like with a healthy dose of shame, right? Around his addiction.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you have a combination too, which is really, when you can get like a 1-2 punch in there, love and shame is great. Identity and shame is great. These are like all ice cream flavors you can mix however you want. It's always going to be good, you know? Uh-huh. So vulnerability is, you know, strengths are the things that we can do. Weaknesses are the things that we can't do. And vulnerabilities are the things that can hurt us. And every character should have a combination of these, but one strong vulnerability that resonates within a character and that you use that character to explore how to deal with that. That is like catnip. We are going to love that. And if the vulnerability is not that believable, or you have Anna Lucia who had this, you know, she shot some guy in the past and then she comes in and she kills Shannon, you know, and that's supposed to be her vulnerability. But you don't really feel that from her. She's so tough and she's so like, so her edges are so rough. We don't really see her.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really feel that from her. And I think they never really get that across. So that vulnerability doesn't really fly. There should be a huge amount of shame for Anna Lucia. And I think that's what they were going for, but it just didn't click. You know, whereas you've got that with, I mean, the shame in Sawyer. I mean, he is reeking of shame right from the get-go, right? And that really works because we all feel that. We all have shame, right? We are basically live in a culture that is designed to shame us no matter what. There is no daylight in our culture between not good enough and who the hell do you think you are? Like, there's nothing. No matter what, we're in a shame spiral for something. And if anybody who's on social media is being shamed for something that they own, you know, that they are. So we live in shame culturally so much that characters that bring a shame vulnerability into the story, I mean, we eat that up. It's catnip.
I wish you could see the enormous smile on my face. This is everything I love in life. Thank you for doing that. So when you frame it that way and you frame the Sawyer vulnerability as, which is something that, you know, Kate kind of nailed him for in the first season. Which I think is why he's so attached to her, is that she saw him, which is, you know, mm-hmm. you want everyone to hate you, but really you don't want that. And so this idea, yeah. this tough guy, I am better off alone. I can do this alone sort of thing. And Ben really nails him at the end of the episode too about the way in which loneliness mm-hmm. can kill you and no man is an island. Yeah. And really your attachment to Kate and to some other people, is a truth that you need to acknowledge about mm-hmm. yourself. It's,
yeah.
You know what? You've really turned me around on this episode.
Okay. Oh, good. I'm glad.
Not that I like hated it before, but I you've helped me see a lot more value to it. You know, if folks want to hear you talk more about story and some of their favorite, storytelling, in the history of culture, where can they find you?
They can find me at Chipperish.com. I run Chipperish Media. There's a number of podcasts that we do. We do Still Pretty about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, just finished up Still Dead about Angel the series. I do a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast called Listen Up A-Holes. And I also do a storytelling podcast called How Story Works, which if you enjoyed any of my nonsense about vulnerability and fear, identity, love, and shame and all of that, that's the kind of thing that I do over at How Story Works. We're just wrapping up our first season of the Conversations on Character, where I did an interview with Josh Siegel, who was one of the producers on The Good Place. We talked to Luke Arnold, who was an actor on Black Sails and just had a book come out. Talked to Jocelyn Jackson, who's a wonderful novelist. So there's some writers on there. If you guys are writers, you're interested in any of that stuff, go to chipperish.com. You'll find everything.
So now is time on this podcast where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. It used to be called the Small Council. It's still called the Small Council, even though we're not a Game of Thrones podcast anymore. So I would like to thank Jordan Rousey, Catherine, Miriam, Aaron Shelley, Crystal Rice, Jillian Walsh, Joe Reynolds, Catherine, Stephanie Berman, Sarah Traits, Aaron Gaworick, Paula Silva, Nate Lulu, Allison Heishman, Andrew Bird, Kelsey Lee Measure, Alex, Matt Pilari, Peter Hobson. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks Lisa, Romney, Lawrence, Medina, Serafina, Cobain, Justin, Way, Aubrey, Amy, GF, Lorenzo, Sandra, Dave L., Michelle Boucher. Yeah, it's Boucher, right?
Yes. Sure.
Good. Amy Schreiner Thomas, Shannon Como, Rachel, Scott McNeil, Monica Wolf, Chris, Jesse Baird, Fainting Violet, Becca Heisner, Andrea Rodriguez Garcia, and Lindsay Mitchell Ernisi. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following humans: Josh Kaluza, Lex Gernon, Ryan James, Emma Maltz, Vio Lane, Kelly Donahue, Abby Ademchek, Michael Weir, Melissa Shippey, Michael Mora, Lewis Walker, Adam Barnum, Claudia Davis, Chip Mims, Annette Monari, Anne Heisek? Yeah, okay, close. Julie Mahoney, Brian Ohm, Will Wallace, and Vic. Thank you, all of you.
And we're back for the storm. What are we chanting? I guess we know about the sub now. Do we not have a chant anymore? In the
sub,
storm?
Sub,
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 sub, sub.
Tumor, tumor,
tumor. Oh, yeah, now I get
X-rays. Ben's tumor, Ben's tumor.
Yeah, we're here in an episode where what do we want to talk about that gets thrown forward?
How obvious it is that it's Ben's tumor?
I mean, that
is it obvious?
Seems pretty obvious.
It's obvious to me, having seen all
I feel
Lost.
Like it's obvious to Jack. You know what I mean?
I feel like it's not that hard for, if you were a call me, to work that one out as well. I don't remember if they worked it out during the live stream, because I don't remember a ton of things that happened on Saturday in general. But like, yeah, like, are we, surely we would have figured that one out. Right.
Well, it's, I mean, the assumption would be, as a television watcher, I think, someone that like likes narrative television is someone we know. And the people that fit the description are Ben and Mr. Friendly and Pickett.
Pickett. Yeah.
And we're going to guess that it's not Pickett. I guess it doesn't matter because we haven't seen anybody exhibit any sort of back or spinal pain or anything. We haven't seen any sort of weakness from the others in terms of like a cancerous growth. So I guess it could be any of those three logically.
In theory, it could be Locke if like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I guess maybe.
You think, well, they're saying that.
I'm trying to think of like who did I think it was at the time, and I can't think of any other than it's either Ben or like Tom, you know.
Yeah, because this was after, you know, I was catching up with the show. I almost guarantee you, I did the entire prison storyline just in like one sit down, like all 6 episodes. Just like let's see what I'm high off hatch explosion, and that carried me all the way through. But I think it's Ben. Ben's tumor seems obvious, and it seems like the most dramatically relevant choice, which I think is the only reason it's a spoiler.
I think Ben, if you really work it out, Ben is the obvious choice, because otherwise, why are they going through all this trouble? You know, like knowing where it ends, knowing that they need Jack to do the surgery. And I think you start to get, this is the first hint we're getting, obviously. Kind of can only be Ben.
So, Joanna, in terms of
what
Ben knows now, is he's kidnapped these three specific Glossies.
Correct.
They're all candidates.
Yes.
But are they all just there to fix his spine?
Jack is.
Well, don't you need the other two to leverage
against Jack? Well, yeah, Jack's there to fix his spine, and Kate and Sawyer are leverage.
Yeah, they're like icing on the cake.
I'm not sure that when the writers wrote the finale of season 2, in fact, I'm quite sure that they did not think that this was the plan for season 3. So at some point they're like, what if Jack has to do spinal surgery on Ben? I'm not saying it's a bad move, but I'm just saying it's like, you know,
it is like, kind of the middling stakes thing you would come up with for like, where do we end? Like going into our break.
I forget how many people know about Ben's tumor. Is it just like the leader class, like the Friendlies and the Juliets, or do all the others know?
I don't know.
Because if it's like a secret keeping thing, I could see, just in terms of keeping the story clean in my mind, if the reality is the writers didn't know that Ben told the others to get them, because like Miss Clue, when she gives the names of people to Michael to bring back way back in season 2, she just knows them as candidates, and the others just assume they're getting candidates.
Right, and the writers know them as the three hot main characters on the show who are right. in love triangle.
Surely that these
all
characters
the writers
are
see are opportunities
for bear cage fucking. So you know,
yeah. I mean, who else is going to have these bear cage moments if it's just Jack?
Later on, like, I feel like things are much more planned out, though not entirely planned out. But right now, we're not in that space. And so it's hard for me to apply what seems like a clear writer's room pivot to, like, a Ben Linus Long Con. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to, especially having watched the finale, this weekend, I was reinvigorated in this idea of, as we're going through the series, trying to track some sort of storytelling logic and seeing if we could patch over those holes or not. Some things are just going to remain holes, as we've learned, with, you know, things like Michael's storyline in season 2 or whatnot, that sort of kind of peter out and didn't have much more meaning. But hopefully, along the way, I can discover a few little nuggets of headcanon that make me feel better about something. And I am always interested in who's leading the others and what their actual motivations are, especially as the season goes on, I think.
I mean, like, especially when we get into, like, a few episodes from now when they try to, like, reframe Goodwin as, like, a nice guy, I'm like, I'm not standing for it. I want to read this email really quickly from a listener named Dave.
Hey.
Because I think it sort of feeds into what we're talking about. So Dave and Sin, wrote in, "Hey guys, I found you during the last season of Game of Thrones when you announced you were doing the Lost rewatch. I was all in. I must have watched the first season 4 or 5 times as I found new people who hadn't seen it yet. My wife, my daughter, and after my divorce, my girlfriend, Sin. We had watched in our separate houses in 2009, simulcasting HBO Go and AOL IM comments. So the stream together seems weirdly comforting. 11 years later, Sin and I are rewatching with you and love the podcast. You three compliment each other's insights and personalities, and I've come to see the characters differently through your eyes. We had a thought about the last episode, Glass Ballerina, so this came in a little while ago. This is the first time the tables have been turned on our thruple, meaning Jack, Sawyer, and Kate. They're no longer in charge. They don't have weapons. They're outnumbered, and they're caged. And it shows what they're made of. Jack, who fashions himself a thoughtful leader, thrashes about in his cage. He doesn't do a good job of getting information from Juliet or Ben, pouts a lot, takes desperate action by attacking Juliet, and makes bad decisions. Sawyer, on the other hand, is way more adaptable and adept. He keeps his sense of humor, stays calm, and evaluates his opponents accurately. Best of all, he has his epiphany with Kate and has moved to kiss her, even though he knows he's going to get beaned. It's a heroic and moving, read hot moment. Kate, who we've always referred to as the Ruiner, that's Davidson, they do not speak for all of us, actually doesn't do anything stupid, even in that awful dress. She keeps splitting rocks and doesn't whine, which we can't say for Jack. So good character rearrangement in this episode. Even the B story echoes this. Saeed, who we're used to seeing as the alpha, dismisses Jin's misgivings at everyone's peril, and it humbles him. Sun also shows that she's more capable than the men she's with. She can sail when Jin refuses. She's the one who fights the others and not only kills one, but gets away. This episode announces that the writers have moved characters who have been in the second seat closer to the front. They're starting to expand the power base. And then Dave said, finally, if there's one thing I hope for in the podcast is to actually freaking understand what the hell was going on the last season or two. I was one of those people who threw up their hands when things got too complex, and I usually love weird shit and don't mind unanswered mystery box questions, but I felt like it got too convoluted at the end and we lost the purity of the first couple seasons. So your explanations and fitting everything together is so welcome, from Dave and Sin. So I just like this idea of like thinking, I wanted us to think sort of maybe even in an even more spoilery way about this idea. Let's narrow it down to Sawyer, Kate, and Jack, which is sort of your question, Dave, of like, what does it do narratively to put these three with their back up against the wall? And is it successful or is it not? I mean, we could reevaluate at the end when they're let go, but do you guys have any thoughts on that?
The thing you said during the column, which is that it's more about the flashbacks that are really kind of grating in these early episodes. Like, I do like the idea of the island stuff, and I like the idea of sort of taking a step away and letting all the characters, well, I mean, it's smart because in terms of drama, you're always looking for a place where your character could, you know, break or pivot or reveal a truth about themselves, and the sort of like prison torture with mysterious purposes is a great way to manufacture that. Maybe a too transparent way, but not an ineffective way. In the sense that I think what Dave and Sin point out about the reversals of the main three sort of revealing how their real stack in the power ranking of Lost, that's all really good. I'm just wondering, like, why they can't successfully do that in the flashback. It's almost like,
I was thinking of the upcoming Kate flashback, which I think is the worst Kate flashback, which is I Do, the right. Nathan Fillion one. Like, they're all bad. They're all bad flashbacks. And it's, yeah, anyway.
Well, just we're not getting a lot of additive plot or character work from them at this point. Like, right. Which is weird, and obviously there's something that they realize and then pivot to, like, the flash forwards. But I think it's, if anything, it's sort of like the sitcom problem, which is, in like old sitcoms, everything had to reset so that you could have no continuity and people could air them out of order and people could just dip in and see the things they like and all the character relationships stay the same. The tension of a flashback structure is the reveals. It's walkabout. It's them. If you could do walkabout for every episode, that is what the flashback structure is excellent at. There's a surprise, there's a mystery, it's core to the character, like all of those things. But if you do that in season 3, you're flashing back to a Sawyer flashback where he's already learned two really important lessons in his, like, at least two really important lessons in his previous flashback episodes. But he's also learning a lesson about himself on the island, which is ultimately the important episode. So this, like, middle section that you're stuck with, the character actually can't change. Because if he changes too much in the prison flashback, then he's not the same Sawyer that lands on the island in the beginning of season one.
Right.
But it's also so far apart from where Sawyer is now in season three that it just reads as a blank nothing because we can't hate him or like him in his flashback.
Right. This is something that Lonnie was talking about, and I can't, honestly, I'm so sorry, I can't recall. We had a long conversation, I had to cut it down for time. I can't recall if this made the cut, but I want to give her full credit for this. She was like, Sawyer, as I understand him, at this point in his life, would not have given, that money, to Clementine. Like, he probably would have kept it. But you can't have that given the progression that Sawyer's made on island. And so it's not like the, you're saying reveal of mystery, and I think that's true, but also it's like the tension of a character shift. And we've already just, like, we've just seen these characters already shift too much. Kate the runner, Sawyer the con man, Jack the, I don't know what, that, like, that tension doesn't really work at this point anymore. And so, like, the Echo flashback is bad, and they're hamstrung by the fact that, like, they're getting rid of Echo. And so that's what's going on there. And then, we get the bad Kate flashback, but then we get Juliet, which is, like, a good episode because we don't know Juliet yet. And that tension of, like, learning who Juliet is and why she's there and why she's another, like, then it's back. You know what I mean? Then we're in, like, good territory. And then you get, like, a Desmond episode, Flash Before Your Eyes, which is, like, good because it's a Desmond episode. The very, very notoriously bad Jack episode, Stranger Strange Land. And then you got something like Trisha Tanaka's Dead, which is, like, does the flashback reveal stuff? Yeah, we meet Hurley's dad, like, which is not something we knew about before. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah.
I feel like at a certain point, it serves some characters better than others. Like, there are some characters we just know better at this point, like Sawyer. Whereas, like, Hurley, we haven't gotten as many Hurley episodes, so there still are things to learn about Hurley.
Right.
But it's like, yeah. So I think if that makes sense to me. The other thing that makes sense to me from that email, if Dave and Sin, if this is what they're saying, if they're saying that what season six of Lost needed was us, then I agree. Yes, it needs, I'm sure we'll all enjoy season six better together.
And then we got a lot, we're getting a lot of Locke emails, and I know this is,
oh, like, I wonder why.
I know this isn't a Locke episode. But I feel like we should at least read one. Is that okay with you, Dave?
let's. Right, I will keep my response brief.
This is from Scott, and it's called John Locke's Specialness Check-in. Love your show, but something's always bothered me about your treatment of John Locke. In further instructions, you keep saying John's not very special, except how he's susceptible to coercion. Well, I agree with the latter. John is special. He's the number four candidate on the cave ceiling. This has some significance, as in the next sequence, 8, Reyes becomes the acting Jacob. The problem with John is that he leaps into causes too quickly, expecting to be immediately rewarded for his faith. If he just waited back in the cut like Hurley, Rose, or Pre-Cloud beat down Mr. Echo, John may have just finished on top. What I love about John's arc in season 3 is that he's set up to become the next leader of the others, but he has to rid himself of his on and off island baggage. In the end, he can't pull the trigger on the literal father of his problems, which is set up in this episode. Which is the further instructions, and will thus always carry it. But what's presented at the end is that between Richard and Ben, and John chooses to trust the wrong person. This is where I get to my other nitpick about your interpretation of what the others want. I always found it weird that Richard, not Ben, ordered John to kill Anthony Cooper. Until you remember that Richard is not beholden to the man in black, while Ben is getting instructions from fake Jacob. I don't understand it, and I need someone. This is me, Joanna. I need someone to make an org flow chart of who is giving, please, 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 I beg of you, if you understand the power structure of Jacob, Man in Black, and the timeline, Jacob, Man in Black, Richard, and Ben, and John, let's say. And if you're feeling Charles, you want to put Charles and Eloise in there too, I would really value it. here's what Scott says.
I would cherish it.
Well, Ben is getting instructions from fake Jacob, Fakeub, in the cabin. Richard is getting the direct feed from Dojin, or time-traveling John himself. Richard has no role to Man in Black's long con, and it's only when Ben drops Jacob's name that Richard responds, believing Ben is actually talking to Jake. So my head hurts. And while I don't think Richard believes John is the one true savior, he knows he's definitely top of the list, but his final fatal flaw in the entire series is jumping to the martyr card too early when all he had to do was wait and let the island's alluring abilities bring the survivors to him. Thank you again for all you do. Scott. So, I just want to say, really quickly, Scott and everyone else who's writing in about John Locke, we are not a monolith when it comes to our interpretations of
John Locke. Hold on a second. I want to be a monolith.
In fact, I would say if there's
you don't
like,
have to feel bad if you're yelling at a monolith. If you're yelling at three people.
If there's a line, Dave and I are on either sides of it, yelling at each other. And Neil is doing what he always does best, which is smiling and trying to get along with everyone and trying to see it from everyone's point of view. So, we disagree on John Locke profoundly.
Yeah, so I have more questions for Terry, actually, about his theory.
Oh, but, about John Locke.
We'll get there.
But, so, I mean, my point is, in all of this, if you're mad at someone, be mad at Dave. Don't be mad at me. I value John Locke.
But my point is, be mad at Dave. I'll take it. I'll take your madness. I think
John Locke is special. And I do value him.
Oh, well, I mean, in that sense that we're all special. You and I were both born in the early 80s.
I will say this. It is fascinating because we just watched the finale, the end, and there is a scene outside the church, as you'll recall, where Ben Linus tells John that he was always jealous of him because he was special. So whether John is special is, I don't know, maybe the show's less interested in that, than like Ben thinks he's special. Like other people think John Locke is special. And I think that's dangerous, you know, cause I think the email is right. John Locke's decisions do lead him down a certain path. So I think that is part of the debate. And I think that'll be really interesting as we sort of, especially as we get into like season four and that stuff.
The moment of the finale that a lot of people responded to, because as you may have heard from listening to this podcast, a lot of our watchers, especially first time watchers, have issues with Jack. There's a part in the finale wherein, you know, the man in black wearing John Locke's face says stuff about, like, starts talking trash on John Locke. And Jack's like, you get his name out of your mouth. You put some respect on that name. Like, Jack standing up for John. And Jack valuing John is one of the most, like, emotionally resonant moments of the whole thing. I do think John Locke is special. But I also do think he's susceptible to coercion. So...
Mm-hmm. Look, if I could time travel and tell immortal beings that I was special, I could be special too.
Okay, I'm starting a new corner called Dave Antagonist of the Podcast Chicken.
That's already John Locke Antagonist Chicken. That's a redundant corner, overlapping corners. I strike it, me and Terry O'Quinn will be over here. He's got a little Jesus pose, but he's full of heroin and I know it. All right. That's going to do it for this week's storm. Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, as you heard from our check-in with Damon and Carlton this week, the next episode is The Cost of Living. It is a Mr. Echo episode, and if you're in the storm, you know that it is the last Mr. Echo episode.
Old clickety-clacks revenge.
I can't believe you read that thing from the pot. That is so you, Dave, to be like... Well, I know we no longer have TV promos to, like, really spoil us, but let me kind of spoil you guys anyway for the death of Mr. Echo.
It's in the podcast. I know.
Honestly, though, in the show's defense, you could be forgiven for thinking that Mr. Echo is already pretty much gone. Like, he's pretty out of it. So
yeah, he hasn't technically woken up this season that
right.
we know.
It's a bonus that they get to bring him back for one. To do one more Echo episode.
That's true, because as Damon said, like, he wandered off at the end of season two, and they're like, buddy, bad news.
You gotta
We're
give
already
us some
killing
time.
Livy and Ana Lucia. We can't kill you, too. They'll all be like, what were the tailies even for? They should have just had Mr. Echo fetch the blankets. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then let Livy, hashtag let Livy live.
All right. Until next week, when we get to say goodbye to Mr. Echo, where can people find more of our work around the internet? We'll start this week with Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, on Twitter at rejects, at one perfect shot. Don't forget to follow our show at Storm Podcasts on the Twitter so that you can vote for all the kissing.
And Joanna Robinson.
Usually you can find me at VanityFair.com, but I'm about to go on book leave, so you won't be able to really find me there. You can find me here on this podcast and occasionally like some old interviews I've already recorded on the Little Gold Men podcast and Truth Versus Hollywood, which is a podcast that I already recorded with Dave Chen. And other than that, I'll just be working all summer and you won't see me. You'll see me on Twitter procrastinating. Don't worry. So yeah, you can find me there. I also want to say, because I think this also got edited out for time or whatever, I just want to give full credit, and I will in future as well, to our guest Lonnie Diane Rich for coining the phrase Big Daddy Marshmallow in reference to Sawyer. I think I repeated it later, and so now it sounds like I came up with it, but I just want you guys to know, definitely, without a doubt, that is a Lonnie Diane Richism, Big Daddy Marshmallow Sawyer. I have it on a post, written on a post-it. It's on my desk now, and I'm just going to try to say it like every episode if I can. So, the end.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where we talk about movies and pop culture. And I think this week you get to hear us play the Cinephiles trivia game, which was good. Check it out.
Did you guys win?
I don't think we won. We were tied and then went into three tiebreaker rounds and I think lost the third one.
I think we did. I think the FSR crew won.
Oh, I see. Well, that doesn't surprise me. The FSR crew was a murderer's row, but, and I, dressed in a suit and had Baby Yoda with me just because I knew if I was gonna fail, it's gonna fail spectacularly.
Oh, so there were no surprises all around.
Yeah. No, everyone was extremely on brand. Now you can listen to it on podcast form, Fighting in the War Room. But I'll also be here every week reminding you, stay upright. It's safer. Do not fall down.